From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, the election that wasn't in Afghanistan, the CIA on trial in Italy, and the cadaver trade in Iraq. Afghanistan and its international partners breathed a collective sigh of relief this week when a much-dreaded runoff election was called off and incumbent President Hamid Karzai was handed a second term. It was hardly an ideal decision by Afghan election officials, given the level of fraud during the first presidential poll in August. A second round was seen by many as vital to help restore Karzai's credibility. But as NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson discovered in Kabul, Afghans care less about who leads them these days than they do about the need for real change.
President Hamid Karzai offered this verbal assurance to his people and the world soon after he was declared the winner.
We'll keep trying our best to address the questions that we have facing Afghanistan and to make sure that the wishes of the Afghan people come true towards an effective, clean government, legally bound, and also at the same time to make sure that the taxpayers' money coming to us from your countries is spent wisely and rightly by us, the Afghan government, and also by the donors themselves.
His main challenger, Abdullah Abdullah, questioned how Karzai could make that pledge, considering the president didn't really win the election. The only reason Karzai's in office, Abdullah told reporters, is because he dropped out last week after concluding the runoff would be more fraudulent than the first round.
A government which is derived from such an illegal decision will not be able to deliver.
Such doubts over what Karzai will achieve during his second term are common, and not just because of a flawed election process.
There's already a cloud over this administration, and it doesn't have to do with this election season. It has to do with the way that President Karzai has governed Afghanistan since 2001.
That's John Dempsey, who heads the Kabul office of the U.S. Institute of Peace. He says Afghans want their government to keep them safe and provide services and employment. That's hardly the case now, with a growing Taliban menace, a stagnating economy, and widespread corruption in which even the lowest civil servants demand bribes before they will do any work.
There's a real opportunity right now, and perhaps a last opportunity, to get things right in Afghanistan.
That sentiment is echoed on the streets of Kabul. Most, like Abdullah, a 20-year-old shopkeeper, are adamant that Karzai delivered during his second term. He says government has to get serious about eliminating corruption. Fatima Nouri, a 38-year-old aid agency worker, says she expects the new administration to do more to curb suicide attacks and to spur job growth, all in the next year or two. Harun Mir believes the deadline is closer. He heads an Afghan think tank called the Center for Research and Policy Studies. He says Karzai has no time to lose.
So he has to set some benchmarks that are achievable within 6 months and then put all of his efforts and focus in order to achieve these benchmarks.
Like punishing high-level government officials involved in corruption and appointing technocrats to help craft a government that is better able to deliver services. Karzai's Western partners are also pressuring him to appoint competent ministers and change the way his government does business. That's because most of the international coalition in Afghanistan is dealing with frustrated constituents back home. They question whether the number of soldiers being killed in Afghanistan and the billions of aid dollars flowing in are worth it. There are plans to set benchmarks which Karzai will have to meet. Again, John Dempsey of the U.S. Institute of Peace.
And about 6 months down the road from the inauguration, there's going to be a major international conference, at which time people will look to those metrics and benchmarks and say, has he made the progress that he promised to over the prior few months? And if not, then they're going to use the levers of financial assistance and military assistance to the country in terms of trying to get him to change his behavior.
But as Afghan analyst Harun Mir and others point out, Karzai doesn't just answer to foreign partners. He has to repay a lot of Afghan power brokers, including notorious warlords, for the support they gave him during the election. They will be seeking cabinet-level appointments and development contracts worth millions of dollars. Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson, NPR News, Kabul.
An Italian judge has delivered the first convictions ever for extraordinary renditions. That's the CIA practice of capturing terrorism suspects in a country and taking them for questioning to another, where torture is often practiced. In Milan, 23 Americans, tried in absentia, and two Italians were found guilty of the 2003 abduction of an Egyptian cleric who says he was taken to Cairo and tortured in prison there. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports.
Lady Robert Seldon, Logan Cinzia Dane.
Reading out the names of the defendants, Judge Oscar Maggi handed down his verdict. The stiffest sentence, 8 years, went to the former Milan station chief, Robert Seldon Lady. Another 22 Americans were each given 5 years in prison. Two Italian members of the Secret Services were sentenced to 3 years. Joanne Mariner, counterterrorism expert at Human Rights Watch, hailed the verdict.
It's an historic judgment. I mean, this is the first case in which the war on terror has been on trial, and I think the judge issued a strikingly powerful repudiation of the war on terror crimes committed by the CIA.
The trial has been politically charged. It began nearly 3 years ago and was obstructed by successive Italian governments, both on the left and the right. Officials saw it as harmful to U.S.-Italian relations and cited state secrecy to try to stop the trial. In March, the Constitutional Court ruled that the prosecution's evidence demonstrating the links between the U.S. and Italian secret services was classified and could not be used. Judge Maggi cited this impediment as the reason for acquitting the two top Italian defendants, the former head of the Italian Military Intelligence Agency and his deputy. He also cited diplomatic immunity for the acquittal of three Americans, including the former Rome CIA station chief Jeff Castelli. Chief Prosecutor Armando Spataro hailed the verdicts as very courageous, sending a strong message to all governments that basic rights cannot be ignored in the fight against terrorism.
It is extremely important that this trial was brought to a final conclusion and that it confirmed the truth of the facts that emerged in our investigation and presentation in court.
The prosecution had charged 26 Americans and 7 Italians with the 2003 kidnapping on a Milan street of the cleric known as Abu Omar. The cleric, who had been under investigation for terrorism, says he was blindfolded and taken to Cairo, where he says he was brutally tortured in prison. The prosecution showed that the operation was very sloppy. The CIA suspects were tracked down thanks to cell phone calls made from near the abduction site and hotel credit card payments, as well as tickets for speeding. Prosecutors said the agents' carelessness was a sign they believed they could operate with impunity. None of the American defendants are likely to serve jail time. Prosecutor Spataro said he's considering the possibility of seeking the extradition of the American defendants who were tried in their absence and were represented by court-appointed lawyers. But he's not optimistic. In Washington, a State Department spokesman said the Obama administration is disappointed with the verdicts. Spataro, nevertheless, says that under the Obama administration, Europeans and Americans will be able to cooperate fruitfully in combating terrorism.
I'm convinced that the Obama administration is absolutely opposed to these illegal practices. Attorney General Eric Holder has himself said these practices will no longer be allowed. I believe this verdict is in line with the Obama administration's human rights policies.
Spataro and his European colleagues clashed repeatedly with the Bush administration over anti-terrorism methods. They say that in a continent with large Muslim minorities, illegal practices such as extraordinary renditions nourish extremism and undermine trust in the democratic system. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Milan.
Coming up, smuggling corpses to a holy city in Iraq.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. Both Iraqi and U.S. officials have expressed concerns about traffic of weapons and drugs across Iraq's porous borders. But there is also an older and more surprising commodity that's being smuggled, cadavers. For centuries, Shiites from all over the world have sought to be buried in what may be the world's largest cemetery in the holy city of Najaf. During the past 30 years, rebellions, invasion, and a war with Iran shut down the traffic of the dead, but it is now once again a big business, as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
The cemetery is called the Valley of Peace, though for the living, it's crowded, dusty, and almost always echoing with the sounds of grief. The tombs and crypts extend for miles in every direction, large enough that different Shiite political factions in Iraq have their own sectors spanning several city blocks. Family members sing prayers over the dead and spill water onto the new graves. As long as there have been funerals here, there has been an industry to receive the dead and their families. Dakhil Shaker has spent his 80 years here in the cemetery of Najaf, he says. His earliest memories are of helping his father and grandfather with the business of funerals and burials. Dakhil can count back his family's five generations in the trade. He's nearly blind now, and despite his thick plastic glasses, he calls out to ask which of his sons are in the room with him. They will bury him someday, he says, and then carry on the business. When Dakhil was a boy, he recalls, desert caravans brought the dead to Najaf.
They used to bring the dead on mules. A mule would carry two bodies with five mules in the caravan. I have seen that with my own eyes. They would stay here for a few days, and we used to offer them a place to stay, and later they would set off back home.
As early as the 16th century, the trafficking of Shiite corpses from as far as India was big business. The Ottoman Empire taxed and regulated the trade, as did the first governments of modern Iraq. The coffins came especially from Iran, the majority Shiite state that shares hundreds of miles of border with Iraq. Sometimes the bodies would be buried a few years in their home country and then transferred to Najaf. In later years, some even came by airplane. The trade ground to a halt with the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s and then the invasion of Kuwait in 1990. After the American invasion in 2003, a huge backlog of bodies from Shiite populations in Kuwait, Lebanon, and Iran started making their way toward Najaf. But it cost thousands of dollars in taxes and fees to transfer a body to Najaf, and only the rich can afford it, says a man who should know. This corpse smuggler only agreed to give an interview anonymously. Afraid of harsh punishments for smuggling, he wouldn't even receive journalists in his lavish home.
Smugglers from Iran and Iraq organize the operation. They meet on dark nights by small rivers and marshes between the two countries. They bribe the guards and the bodies cross the border.
Sneaking across such a tense border in the dark puts the smugglers in some seriously bad company. Drug runners use the same routes, as do traffickers in all sorts of weapons and explosives bound from militias or criminal gangs. But the smuggler admits the money is good, which explains why anyone still takes the risk. The authorities are not lenient. The smuggler says they recently jailed an entire funeral party, the family, pallbearers, and the driver of the hearse, on suspicion that the body was illegally trafficked from Iran. Still, the Valley of Peace grows, regardless of how far the caskets have traveled, and whether they flew here from Lebanon, or were smuggled from Iran, or were carried a short distance from Iraq's latest tragedy. Najaf's undertakers continue their trade as their great-grandfathers did before them. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Baghdad.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.